Charm of Favor, Chapter 12.
The Stennis Space Center is a NASA rocket testing facility, just about a 90-minute drive from Hattiesburg. With the end of the Apollo and Shuttle programs, use of the 13,500-acre base declined, collapsing the economies of the surrounding communities. Over the years, other government organizations and commercial companies have moved in and out of the buildings and warehouses scattered throughout the properties. Mostly, the land is covered with trees, making it a natural sound dampener for the testing of boosters and hybrids between jets and rockets. Basically, anything that is loud and dangerous can be tested in the remote forests of Hancock County, Mississippi, on the banks of the Pearl River. Rolls-Royce, Lockheed Martin, and a dozen other companies are constantly looking for engineers, mechanics, welders, and pipe fitters to construct, modify, and operate the various test stands and support systems. There are also hundreds of job openings for programmers, quality assurance, and validation engineers, just like Adnan. Just about anyone fluent in C++ or the various validation and simulation platforms that can earn decent money in the private sector. But companies that sell to the U.S. government have salary requirements that are tied to a prevailing wage, based upon the zip code of the place of employment. For this reason, it is very difficult to attract such skills to Hancock County, Mississippi. In addition, since Hurricane Katrina cleaned up the real estate market, there are remarkably few choices for housing that would motivate someone to move from Silicon Valley to Hattiesburg. It doesn't even have a guitar center. It's been more than 60 years since the U.S. successfully tested the first hydrogen bomb. There is a vast difference between the technology for a criticality-based explosion of splitting atoms and one resulting from the fusion of protons together. It is perhaps more complex than the difference between sailing to the New World in 1492 and landing on the moon in 1969. It is so complex that only four other countries, Russia, France, China, and the UK, have been able to accomplish a fusion explosion themselves. A few more countries, India, Pakistan, South Africa, Israel, as well as North Korea, have the know-how to build simpler forms of nuclear weapons, atomic bombs, but no other technology in the world has remained out of the hands of so many countries for such a long time. It is said that when Lucifer watched God form Adam from dirt, he said, "That doesn't look that hard. I can do that." And when Lucifer reached down to gather some dirt to try it on his own, God said, "Just a moment. You need to go get your own dirt." The first great challenge to forming a fusion explosion is to make the fuel. Mastering the use of one of the strongest forces in the universe is not easy. In fact, up until 1945, it was completely theoretical. The strong nuclear force that holds positively charged particles in an atom together acts over very tiny distances, but it is 100 trillion trillion times stronger than gravity. The simple technical journey, like that of Christopher Columbus's Santa Maria, is to pull the proton and neutron apart. The snap of energy forms a chain reaction as the neutrons fly apart and tear other atoms apart. Then those tear other atoms apart. Shooting two lumps of enriched uranium-235 at one another in a small cannon barrel will get the reaction started and level a few dozen city blocks. The more complex technical journey is somewhat in reverse. Instead of tearing the atom apart, hydrogen protons, the heaviest in the universe, are compressed together to fuse into a new atom of helium, which has much lighter protons. The loss of that tiny amount of mass times the speed of light squared is the theoretical amount of pure energy released. To see such a reaction in action, simply look up at the sun. Our sun and most stars are nothing but massive fusion reactors. Observing snapshots of various stages of stars in the cosmos displays more or less, the process by which God makes a sun to rule over the day. Man makes a sun in a fraction of the amount of time. Man must make his own dirt. Nuclear weapons require nuclear fuel. Very few types of atoms are both the right size and abundant enough to make a nuclear weapon. Either uranium or plutonium is required for atomic bombs, the latter of which is made in a sort of high-speed cotton candy machine, where the neutron sugar is spun into uranium until it's heavy enough to do the job. The fuel required for a sun is a mixture of deuterium and tritium. These molecules were so rare that it must be made from scratch, using 1 cup of hydrogen and 1 or 2 cups of neutrons. To collect weapons-grade uranium is not easy. You need a concentrated, enriched lump of the less stable form uranium-235, which is only about 1% of naturally occurring uranium. The other 99%, uranium-238, doesn't work for an atomic bomb because it doesn't split apart easily enough. Separating these two forms, or isotopes, which are identical in almost every way but differ slightly in weight, is hard and requires a lot of energy. In the 1940s, Fermi and Einstein designed a plant in Chicago that enriched uranium that covered more than 40 acres of land, with 100 miles of piping, and thousands of heaters and compressors to turn the metallic uranium into a gas, so the isotopes could be separated. The first test weapon utilized plutonium-239 in a fantastically complex design of an implosion device. Nothing like it had ever been crafted, and the opinion it might not work at all was common among the scientists and engineers that worked on it. Because of its complicated firing mechanism, and the need for previously untested synchronization of explosives and precision design, it was thought that a full test of the concept was needed before the scientists and military representatives could be confident it would perform correctly under combat conditions. On the 16th of July, 1945, it was proposed an explosion that so astonished the observers at the Trinity test site located in the Jornada del Muerto Desert, about 35 miles southeast of Sirocco, New Mexico, that Oppenheimer quoted Sanskrit by saying, "Now I have become death, the destroyer of worlds." The shockwave was felt over 100 miles away. President Harry S. Truman, appointed after the death of Franklin Roosevelt, was informed that the theory was correct and that the gadget had worked. He immediately wrote Executive Order 11652 to Commanding General United States Army Strategic Air Forces General Spatz, authorizing the use of the special weapon on Hiroshima. The second weapon utilized 130 pounds of uranium and was hurriedly placed into gun-type mechanism codenamed Little Boy. It was dropped on the Japanese city of Hiroshima on the 6th of August, 1945, during World War II, by the Boeing B-29 Superfortress Enola Gay, piloted by Colonel Paul W. Tibbets, Jr., commander of the 509th Composite Group of the United States Army Air Forces. The third weapon, designed again utilizing the Fat Man design developed for the Trinity test with a core that weighed barely 17 pounds. There were three weapons built, numbered F-31, F-32, and F-33. They used detonators that were fired by fully charged lead-acid batteries located inside the bomb shell. If the bomb was not used within 70 hours, the batteries had to be removed, recharged, and placed back into the bomb. F-31 was partially disassembled to test the batteries, and it was utilized for the next attack on Japan. The original target for the bomb was the city of Kokura, but it was found to be obscured by clouds and drifting smoke from fires started by a major firebombing raid by the 224 B-29s on nearby Yahata the previous day. This covered 70% of the area over Kokura, obscuring the aiming point. Three bomb runs were made over the next 50 minutes, burning fuel and repeatedly exposing the aircraft to the heavy defenses of Yawata. But the bombardier was unable to drop visually. By the time of the third bomb run, Japanese anti-aircraft fire was getting close, and Second Lieutenant Jacob Besser, who was monitoring Japanese communications, reported activity on the Japanese fighter direction radio bands. It was only a matter of time before Japanese Zeros would cut the B-29 to pieces. Sweeney then proceeded to the alternative target, Nagasaki. It, too, was obscured by clouds, and Ashworth ordered Sweeney to make a radar approach. At the last minute, the bombardier, Captain Kermit K. Behan, found a hole in the clouds. The fat man was dropped, and following a 43-second duration freefall, it exploded at 11:02 local time at an altitude of about 1,650 feet above the ground. Because of poor visibility due to cloud cover, the bomb missed its intended detonation point by almost 2 miles, and damage was somewhat less extensive than that in Hiroshima. The bomb was far more powerful than the fission-type weapon dropped on Hiroshima. An estimated 35,000 to 40,000 people were killed immediately. Another 30 to 40,000 died from long-term health effects, a slow and agonizing death the entire world witnessed. Most of the direct deaths and injuries sustained from the bombing were munitions or industrial workers, not soldiers. It was the last time nuclear weaponry had ever been used against humans. The horror was so vast that the threat of using such weapons would prevent war between nuclear-capable countries. The ancient syndicate spent centuries bringing mankind to a full understanding of weaponry powerful enough to end all life. It became possible to capture the world merely with the fear of using them. Sanity, however, prevailed. Though nearly 3,000 weapons were tested, none was used to kill another human being. All that was required now was to create the appearance of a leader who could actually do it again. The problem with tritium, an isotope of hydrogen, is that there is nearly no naturally occurring tritium, so it has to be synthesized. This is done in specially designed reactors, which aren't easy to build and generate tiny amounts of tritium at a time. It is extremely small, making it difficult to contain. It is highly radioactive, with alpha decay similar to radon gas, but is almost impossible to detect unless it is very close. In gaseous form, it is fairly safe. A solid sphere of tritium and deuterium the size of a basketball, imploded to the size of a walnut, can produce an efficient release of energy equivalent to 1,000 times that of Nagasaki. The design challenge is holding the atomic explosion long enough, under sun-like conditions, to kickstart fusion. Traditionally, this has been accomplished with a nuclear fission explosion. In other words, an atom bomb sets off a hydrogen bomb. But the payoff can be thousands of times more destructive than an atom bomb. The biggest hydrogen bomb ever tested, Tsar Bomba, weighing more than 50,000 pounds and was more than 3,000 times bigger than the atomic bomb that was used in Hiroshima. It was tested in 1961 in a remote part of Russia. Anyone within 65 miles of the blast would suffer third-degree burns from the radiation released. The vast wave broke window panes 550 miles away. It was all part of the building the fear. For a weapon of this size and weight could never be delivered to its target without being destroyed by enemy aircraft long before reaching it. There was no fear of something very large like this. There was fear, however, in something very small. But accomplishing something so powerful, so small, and so terrible would require advanced knowledge in microelectronics. It would require nanotechnological metallurgy skills far surpassing the gallium-plutonium casting techniques used by previous weapons designers. It would require decades of isolation from the world with supercomputers specifically designed to simulate the quantum possibilities of high-energy neutrons injected billionths of a second after the explosion of a few ounces of compressed tritium began. It would require a pure and merciless soul to keep a scientific community and a military command structure from losing their resolve. The only society capable of crafting microelectronics of this nature is located in Korea. The only place isolated enough and immersed in hatred enough to focus on a nuclear detonator that would fit into a gym bag was North Korea. The priceless research and designs were delivered to them under the direction of President Bill Clinton on May 11, 1999. Although the New York Times reported the only thing transferred was the technology for exploding bolts that would facilitate the final stage separation of a multi-stage rocket, they continued to help them develop their first nuclear weapon, which was successfully tested on the 9th of October, a little more than 6 years later. It is virtually impossible to have created a nuclear bomb with a tidy 2 kiloton yield in that amount of time without close corroboration with Western science. Less than 3 years later, on the 25th of May, 2009, they tested a vastly improved design with 5.4 kilotons of explosive power. The micro-sized weapons were not designed to dig holes a mile wide. They were designed to be small enough to be easy to deploy and to create an electromagnetic pulse capable of burning out integrated circuits for hundreds of miles. By the 3rd of September, 2017, they had succeeded 9 times and finally learned how to supercharge the explosion with tritium to a level of 280 kilotons, enough to obliterate an entire major city and wipe out electrical circuits up to 1,000 miles away. The fact that the technology was so powerful is frightening enough. The realization that it was developed through a secretly joint effort with Clinton's massive syndicate is simply chilling to behold. It is the possession of such a weapon by a madman like Kim Jong-un that should put the entire world on high alert. There is no reason to think the Clinton playbook will not be used. If the Clintons' enemies get too annoyed or the press gets too close to reporting the truth, little Kim may receive his marching orders to send a nuclear care package to the United States. The official story from the propaganda press would have people believe that such a weapon would have to be delivered with an intercontinental ballistic missile, and that we would have about 45 minutes to shoot it harmlessly out of the sky. North Korea would even test dozens of empty decoys to make sure the world stayed focused on that narrative. But the syndicate is deceptive. The North Koreans may simply place submarines off the East Coast, the West Coast, and the Gulf Coast, that each have the capability of launching missiles from beneath the surface. These missiles are capable of carrying a nuclear warhead. It is all too easy to hide a submarine among the mostly abandoned 25,000 oil rigs along American coasts. They just have to sit there for months at a time, waiting for the orders to come. If a missile is launched from one of these secret locations, it may strike its target in about 6 minutes. What can you get done in 6 minutes? The press would also have the public believe there are 17 different intelligence agencies. There are not. There are only 17 different political appointees that can take classified information in 17 different directions at once, all under the command of the syndicate. The Clinton crime syndicate laid the groundwork by appointing each and every one of these agency directors. The planned attack on the World Trade Centers on September 11, 2001, provided the opportunity to implement thousands of pages of previously crafted law, designed for the sole purpose of instantly changing the world into a surveillance state, completely under the auspices of one global authority. The syndicate seized control of every airport on the planet, with scheduled airline service within weeks. Never before has any authority acted with such power and such effectiveness. The public was led to believe the changes were to stop terrorism. The true purpose was to provide this central authority the power to define terrorism in their own terms. In less than 10 years, once a person committed an offense against this authority, every move, every contact they had made, going back for months, could be traced. What became very apparent very quickly was that members of the syndicate were not investigated. Only enemies of this new deep state were investigated. The only question remaining was whether that enemy could be used to further the mission of the syndicate or not. That mission has not changed in thousands of years. Deep in the forests surrounding the Stennis Space Center, the process of chilling and compressing tritium is simple and indistinguishable from the process of producing and storing hydrogen for the testing of rocket boosters. No one would miss a few hundred pounds of liquid hydrogen. Most of the valves and connections throughout the test buildings leak that much in a single day. The compressor arrived over a series of weeks, one piece of micro-machine tool steel at a time. Some parts came from Texas, some came from Louisiana, some came from Florida. The rest came from Detroit by car and by bus. Adnan worked quietly for Rolls-Royce as a C++ programmer. The drawings of various booster systems were divided into compartments by government policy guidelines. No program group would see any more of the drawing than what was assigned to their group. The program language controlled various actuators, solenoids, and rotating valves. The inputs of real-world information arrived from thermocouples sensing temperature, from transducers sensing strain or pressure, and the stress placed on various structural components by thrust and changes in atmospheric pressure. The program had to insert the inputs into sequences of complexes of virtual circuits that made timers, counters, and switches to control the outputs so that the booster would function. Each program had to be validated and debugged. There were protocols and quality standards that usually slowed the entire process to a crawl because they had to be stitched together so that one section of the program would integrate with the other sections of the program without forming loops, echoes, or dead ends. It was a world that only a hardcore programmer could love. There was no room for errors. There were programs to help find the errors, but at the end of the day, it was the human mind that created the system. Once an employer discovered such a human mind, there were always concessions that had to be made. Strange diets, musical tastes, and even sexual orientations were tolerated and managed by very talented people capable of juggling various psychotic tendencies to get the job done. Programmers never saw a reporter. They never went on camera. They rarely saw sunshine. No one cared at all if someone wanted to live in an old pump shop deep in the woods, running on solar panels and old forklift batteries.